From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan has written her memoirs. On today's Fresh Air, she talks with us about her family, astrology, and just saying no. Also, choreographer Elliot Fell tells us about making classical ballet and modern dance compatible. Milo Miles discusses another rock star taking inspiration from world music, Peter Gabriel. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new version of Shakespeare's Henry V. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. East Germany announced today that it will accept free elections and a democratic coalition government, but according to a communique issued today by the administration of newly installed Communist Party leader Egon Krenz, such a measure is possible only if opposition groups accept a constitutional provision allowing the communists to dominate the government. East German border guards today tore away parts of the Berlin Wall as thousands of people poured through checkpoints and into the West. Within the government, Communist Party purged two hardline members of the Central Committee and four members of the ruling Politburo. East Germany's ambassador to Washington today said events in his homeland were a radical change and mean a revolutionary renewal of socialism. And Ambassador Gerhard Herder said the developments in East Berlin were irreversible. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Ambassador Herder called the opening of the Berlin Wall historic and permanent. All fortifications and barricades on the structure, he said, will be removed. However, Herder said East Germany's problems go beyond mere concrete.
The problem is to build an attractive socialism, a socialism which would be so attractive that no anymore would like to leave it.
Herder said the measured response to the changes in East Germany by President Bush is encouraging and expressed the hope that a new phase in East German-U.S. relations would result. However, he cautioned that the developments in East Berlin could be dangerous should demonstrations get out of control. Herder raised the possibility of armed response by East German authorities, which he said could lead to an armed conflict with the West. However, he stressed the intent of East German leaders to solve their problems with political means without resorting to violence. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Congress is moving closer to voting on a comprehensive child care package, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Last night, House and Senate negotiators worked out most of the stumbling blocks to a child care package. They agreed on a $1.75 billion bill that would fund expanded Head Start programs, grants to states to set up child care programs, and money for before and after school daycare. Details of a proposal to give earned income tax credits to poor working families with children must be negotiated next week. Child care advocates say they're pleased that the logjam has finally been broken on the bill, but they are anxious to see a vote scheduled on it before Congress leaves for recess. The bill goes far beyond what President Bush first proposed for child care. He wanted the program limited to tax credits only. But the president hasn't said whether he will veto the bill in its current form. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose just under 22 points to close at 2625.61. Advances led declines 9-5 on volume of 132 million shares. This is NPR News. Bulgarian President Todor Zhivkov resigned today. His successor, Foreign Minister Petar Mladenov, said there is no alternative to restructuring. Zhivkov is 78 years old. He bowed out after 35 years in power. Mladenov has been foreign minister since 1971. He pledged complete openness of information and active dialogue with the people. A body has been discovered in the rubble left behind by last night's crash of a Navy jet into an apartment complex in a suburb of Atlanta, Georgia. Ed Hula has the latest.
It was late this afternoon when searchers found the body of a man inside one of the apartments struck directly by the Navy Corsair A-7. The man was last seen by some residents entering his apartment only moments before the crash, which destroyed the apartment and about half a dozen others. Three other people remain hospitalized in serious condition today. A mother and her 5-year-old daughter are being treated for burns, while the pilot who ejected before the crash suffered head injuries. Officials say they don't expect expect to find any more bodies in the debris from the crash. Naval investigators from Norfolk, Virginia, are now on the scene trying to figure out why the jet crashed on what was considered an otherwise routine training mission. For National Public Radio, this is Ed Hulip in Atlanta.
President Bush today proposed a $4.2 billion package designed to help first-time homebuyers and the poor buy houses and the homeless receive shelter. He also vowed to change the destructive practices that have blocked affordable housing in inner cities. Half of the money would be used for grants to help residents of low-income housing buy their units. Nicaragua's government and the U.S.-backed Contras made progress during talks on a truce today, as well as amnesty and disbanding the rebels. The Contra military commander, chief negotiator Enrique Bermudez, said there have been certain advances. The leftists and Sandinistas are close to agreement on a ceasefire. This is National Public Radio News. I'm Frank Stachow.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former First Lady Nancy Reagan has written her memoirs. She writes, "During our White House years, I said almost nothing about how I really felt regarding the controversies that swirled around me. There were so many things that I longed to say, but couldn't. It just wouldn't have been appropriate." Her new book, My Turn, is co-written with William Novak. I spoke with Nancy Reagan from the NPR Bureau in New York and asked her about the best and worst parts of being out of the White House.
Well, the best part, I suppose, is not being quite so much under the microscope as you were as First Lady. The worst part is that you really do miss the friends that you made in Washington and the staff, wonderful, wonderful, the telephone operators, the butlers, the maids, everybody who'd been there for so long and who I still hear from, which is nice. You miss the support system. As I've said often before, I'll say it again. When you needed a plumber, you had a plumber right away.
There's really no job description for First Lady. How did your view of your job as First Lady evolve in the two terms that you were in the White House?
Well, no, there is no job description, and everybody, every First Lady, I think, makes it what she wants to make it. For me, the first year and a half, were very, very rocky years. But then I became so involved with the drug program that everything kind of then got better, and I was happier, and I didn't really pay that much attention, but my efforts were focused on other things.
You say the first couple of years were very hard for you. The syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman pointed out that you didn't seem to have the Teflon that your husband did. The press, for the most part, treated your husband very gently during those early years, yet you were often criticized in the press.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder why you thought that your press was so much more negative than your husband's.
I don't know. It's true. He didn't get the criticism that I got. First of all, it's very hard to dislike my husband. And maybe because they couldn't get to him, they got to me. And maybe I did things that if I'd known Washington better, I wouldn't have done at the time. You know, it's interesting that there are only two first ladies that I know of, anyway, who came to Washington without knowing Washington at all. I knew nothing, absolutely nothing.
Nancy Reagan is my guest, and she, by the way, has written a new memoir called My Turn. The issue that you took on while you were in the White House was the war on drugs, your Just Say No campaign. Why did you choose that as the issue?
Oh, when my husband was governor of California, and it began to surface, and I began to get calls from friends whose children were on drugs, and many times tragically so, they died. But that was at a time when nobody knew anything about drugs. They were embarrassed about drugs. They were embarrassed to admit that their children or anybody they knew were on drugs. And that was when I started to get interested. So it was way back then. And then when I got to the White House, you have a wonderful platform that you'll never have again. And you really should use it if there's something that interests you.
Critics have said that the rhetoric of the Just Say No campaign was not matched by either political will or necessary funding in the Reagan administration. In fact, the Reagan administration cut money from drug rehabilitation programs as you were working on the Just Say No campaign. Did you ever feel that your husband or his administration was working at cross purposes to your anti-drug campaign?
No, I never did. My husband was as concerned as I was. I have often thought and said that I think that there should be more more working together between the East Wing and the West Wing. This has long been they just don't work together.
Explain what you mean there by the difference between the East Wing and the West Wing.
Well, the East Wing is the First Lady's wing, and the West Wing is my husband's wing.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you ever talk to your husband about how cutting drug rehabilitation programs would affect the war on drugs?
Well, you see, I don't think he did cut drug rehabilitation programs. We get into an argument here, but I don't think he did. Neither does he. And I think in the long run, I don't think that money is the solution to drugs. I think that education, teaching children when they learn to read and write about drugs, when they learn to read and write, then you should teach them about drugs. Do you know how the Just Say No slogan came into being, by the way?
Why don't you describe it?
I was in Oakland talking to some children, and one little girl said, "Well, Mrs. Reagan, what do you do when somebody offers you drugs?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. You just say no," never dreaming that it would be what it became. Actually, it was wonderful because it did provide a kind of a rallying point. It became part of our vocabulary, and now there are 15,000. Just Say No programs across the states. There's one in Japan, as a matter of fact.
You can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it always seemed to me that the Just Say No slogan was geared to young people who were up against peer pressure. And I was wondering if you thought that it was effective at all among either people who were a little older, among people who were already hooked, or among teenagers who were very poor, where there wasn't much hope of employment or money coming in.
Yes, I do. But then, of course, by the same token, I have to say, this is our biggest problem.
Which is the biggest problem?
The children who are in ghettos, who don't see any future for themselves. That's where the public service announcements come in, very handy. And people going to these schools or programs or whatever, who have been there and who know, and well-known people, I mean, and they identify with them, and hopefully, I mean, it's a long way around. The education program is a long way around, but believe me, if you closed every border, I don't mean that you shouldn't try to. I certainly do think so. And if you had a policeman on every corner, which I think would be wonderful. But in the long run, you have to take the customer away from the product. And that's what's going to save you, I think.
Your husband was criticized for what's been described as his thunderous silence on the subject of AIDS. His first AIDS address was in 1987, and the statistics that the journalist Randy Schultz offers is that by the time President Reagan made his first address, 36,058 Americans had been diagnosed with AIDS, 20,849 had died. Had you ever urged him to speak out sooner?
Well, he had appointed a commission to study the AIDS problem. My brother, as a matter of fact, in Philadelphia, was involved in that.
And that commission was appointed after the Senate passed a unanimous resolution urging the president to appoint it.
You seem to be talking an awful lot about AIDS and drugs and not my book, but anyway. No, it was never a lack of interest. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you of all of the private things he did, but he did a lot.
I've kind of figured that with your associations in the fashion world and in the acting world that you probably know a lot of people who are gay.
Oh, yes?
And I was wondering if they ever urged you to urge your husband to speak out about AIDS and to speak out compassionately about the people who had it. Well, I mean, to speak out sooner and to speak out sooner and to emphasize the compassion instead of mandatory testing programs.
No, he did. I'm sorry, but he did. Whether it was reported or not, he did. I was there. He did.
My guest is Nancy Reagan, and she's written her memoirs. It's called My Turn. And we'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Nancy Reagan is my guest. One of the subjects you address in your new book, My Turn, is astrology. It was first revealed in Don Regan's book that you had hired an astrologer after the assassination attempt on your husband. Do you want to explain why you decided to use an astrologer then?
Have you read the book?
Yes. But why don't you explain it in your words, because I'm not sure our listeners have read it yet.
Well, I hope that's a very important thing, that they read the whole book and not just read excerpts, who tend to take just the buzz words and string them all together. To go through a shooting of your husband after only 3 months in Washington is an experience that I hope nobody has. It's a terrible, terrible experience. And he came very close to dying. I don't think most people knew that then. I don't think most people know it now. But there were two times that they came to me and said they couldn't find his pulse. And they couldn't find the bullet. He was very close to going into shock. And if he had, that would have been it. It was a terribly traumatic experience that does not leave you. And I went through a very rough period, a very tough period. And you reach out for any kind of a crutch that you can when you go through anything like this. And I reached out for my minister, my friends. And then when a friend called me and said, I know this lady who said that she had... If she'd only could have gotten to you, she could have told you that he shouldn't have done anything that day. And I thought, oh, my Lord. I could have saved him, maybe. And so I called her. And she became a crutch for me, along with other crutches.
Did your husband believe in astrology?
No.
Then how come he let you... affect his schedule through the advice?
He did not. He didn't even know I was doing it. It's very hard to explain to somebody what this is like until you've gone through it. It differs from having cancer, which he did, I did. But being shot is something that's entirely different. I thought, well, if it meant changing, if he left at 2 o'clock, would he be safer than if he left at 4 o'clock? I didn't see anything wrong with it. Nobody was hurt. He's still alive, and I just didn't see anything wrong with it.
Did you ever ask for your own charts while you were consulting with the astrologer?
No, she just gave those to me.
Your charts?
My chart.
And how did they affect your schedule and the way you ran your life?
No, I can't say. My concern was Ronnie.
So you didn't schedule your own day or week around your astrology charts?
No.
When did you give it up? Did you give it up?
I did. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. It, at the end, it really became more of a habit than, you know, a real need.
Nancy Reagan is my guest, and she's written a new memoir called My Turn. I want to ask you about family. Ronald Reagan ran on a platform of traditional family values, and he was elected with the support of the moral majority. It seems to me that, in a way, you are from anything but a traditional family, in the sense that your parents divorced shortly after you were born. Your mother went on the road when you were very young, and you were brought up in those early years by your aunt.
Because she had to.
I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. Please don't interpret it that way. President Reagan was the first divorced man to be elected president of the United States. It's nationally known that there have been periods when you've been on bad terms with your own children. Both Patty and Ron have at times lived out of wedlock with their lovers. I was wondering if you ever felt that your husband was asking Americans to buy into a vision of the American family that was very unlike the family you were from or the family you created.
No. He was giving his opinion and what he felt about what a family should be. It doesn't mean that every family turns out that way. Every family has problems. Every family. But when you try to solve those problems on the front pages of the papers, that's difficult.
Please understand, I'm not trying to criticize families for having problems. My question is more about this creation of an idealized family in which there are no problems.
No, I don't think that's what he would hope for, and that's what he believes in. I mean, whether you agree with that or not, I don't know, but he would hope for it. And I must say that our family now it was a very difficult 8 years, because everything we did was magnified and on the front pages and misunderstood by both sides. But now it's all right.
I think some people felt that the Reagan administration, through presenting this view of a traditional family, was creating policies that didn't take into effect the way families had changed, ways similar to what your family, how your family had changed. And I'm thinking here, you know, that there are families where there was working women or a single working mother, families in which there were unemployment, families that need daycare because both parents worked. This was the kind of family that was not really addressed in the Reagan administration. You didn't see an emphasis on daycare or an emphasis on single working mothers. And in fact, some of the services were cut back that would support families like that.
You keep talking about that, about that my husband cut back on everything. That is just not true. He believed strongly that there was too much government interference in family life, in family decisions. But this this emphasis on cutting back programs is I'm sorry, it's not just not true. And I wish that, are you sure you read the book?
Well, I have read your book, but I mean, the Reagan administration did cut back many social service programs because...
Yes, because he felt there was too much government interference.
Right. So, but we're agreeing now that funds to many social service programs were cut back during the Reagan administration.
Some, because he felt there was too much government interference, and it could be done by privately.
Do you think it was done privately?
Yes, I do.
I know you don't get to walk through cities on your own very much because of security problems, but I know when I walk through New York or Philadelphia, the cities I live in or I'm closest to, I see homeless people on the streets of just nearly every major street. And it makes me wonder if volunteerism really worked. I wonder what you think about that.
No, I'm sorry. I think that volunteerism does work, and I think it is working. And, I don't know what you expect me to answer. I can't answer political questions. This is not a political book. I thought we were going to talk about my book and not about politics. And I'd be happy to talk about my book, but I'm not going to talk about politics. I'm sorry.
Okay. When you use the term family values, what do you mean by it?
I mean, I would like to see a closer family setup. I remember when I was growing up, and certainly when my husband was growing up, it wasn't unusual to see the mother and father and children and grandparents living in the same house. I think that's wonderful. But I think we've gotten away from that, and I think we should get back to it, and I think that'll be healthy for our country and for ourselves.
But it seems to me when you were growing up, you really weren't in it anyways. Your parents were divorced. Your mother was on the road as an actress. You grew up with your aunt. I mean, I guess what I'm wondering here is if you've created a nostalgia for something that you never quite lived through yourself, a nostalgia for something that perhaps didn't really exist.
No, it did exist. My mother was divorced when I was, just after I was born. She did not take alimony, and she had to go back to work. And she didn't think that hauling me around from town to town would be of any help to me. And so I lived with my aunt and uncle in Bethesda, Maryland, my cousin, her sister, which was a very loving, wonderful household. But I miss my mother.
Well, we're out of time. I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Nancy Reagan's new memoir is called My Turn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And next time, the woman who co-wrote the songs Natural Woman, Locomotion, Up on the Roof, and Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, Carole King. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. played Baby John in the stage and screen versions of West Side Story, but Elliot Feld is better known as the founder of a ballet company that integrates classical and modern dance. Coming up, we meet the founder of the Elliot Feld Ballet. Also, Milo Miles looks at another rock star who's drawn from world music, Peter Gabriel. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Henry V, the new movie version of the Shakespeare play starring and directed by Kenneth Branagh. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The East German government has announced that it will break through the Berlin Wall to make additional border crossing points for the thousands of people in East Berlin who want to visit West Berlin. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from East Berlin.
Tens of thousands of people waited for hours today to cross into the West. Cars were backed up into many of East Berlin's main thoroughfares as they approached several of the checkpoints. Many travelers are beginning to come from other parts of East Germany outside Berlin to cross, and the flow shows no signs of letting up. To alleviate the pressure, the East Germans have already begun bulldozing the wall in at least two places and plan to add a total of 8 new checkpoints over the next 4 days. One of those will be at the famous Glenicke Bridge, scene of many East-West spy swaps. The government has also announced that the wall will be open permanently, hoping that East Berliners will spread out their travel to the West and thus ease the strain on the city's transport system. I'm Mike Schuster in East Berlin.
East Germany also announced today that it will accept free elections and a democratic coalition government, but this is apparently tied to a provision giving the communists the right to dominate the government. A spokesman for the Soviet Foreign Ministry repeated his country's position on the continuing need for an independent East Germany today. Bridget Candle of the BBC reports from Moscow.
Despite its fraternal links with East Berlin, Moscow, like everywhere else, had been surprised by the speed of change in East Germany, according to Mr. Gerasimov. But he called the move to open the East German border a wise decision. The flow of so many people westwards was economically and politically damaging and had to be stopped, he said. But the Soviet spokesman also issued a sharp warning to West Germany. Bonn should take into account, he said, that any reconsideration of borders would not suit any government in Europe and would only cause distrust. The rules may have changed, he added, but the frontier remains. And he repeated his comment from yesterday that so long as NATO and the Warsaw Pact continued to exist, so would the divisions between the two halves of Europe.
Bridget Kendall, the BBC in Moscow. There's been fighting in Soviet Moldavia between nationalist and police forces. There are reports that dozens of people have been injured. Reuters is reporting the fighting, which started in the early evening, continued for several hours. President Bush, speaking in Dallas, said today that the rapid, dramatic change in East Germany and elsewhere in Eastern Europe offers much hope and deserves continued encouragement. In comments at the start of a speech on housing, the president took note of East Germany's decision to open its borders for the first time in years and pledged to seize every opportunity to contribute to lasting peace and to extend democracy. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 22 points to close at 2,625.61 on volume of some 131,800,000 shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Artists and performers rarely let outsiders see their warm-ups or preliminary work, but recently Peter Gabriel defied convention and released a record of music that he used as source material and inspiration for his soundtrack for Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ. World music critic Milo Miles says the soundtrack and its sources show not only how Gabriel worked, but a lot about the difference between folk music and pop music.
Scratch many rock and roll activists, particularly the British ones, and you'll find a school teacher, a moral reformer with a good sense of rhythm. So when that old sledgehammer man, Peter Gabriel, put out not only his Scorsese movie soundtrack, Passion, but Passion Sources, the music he studied to write the soundtrack, you know he was trying to teach us a lesson. Fortunately, Gabriel is a sly and funky professor. See, he was set to provide accompaniment for this whacked-out version of a Bible story. So naturally, he drew on the Middle East for singers and fiddlers and Northern Africa for desert dance beats. That's a workout popular with Egyptian farmers who are known as Fallahim. Gabriel needed some drones and spacey effects as well, so he called on some Indian musicians like veteran jazz fusion violinist El Shankar. To finish off his stew, Gabriel tossed in a bit of Ethiopian bar band, some Sufi religious music, and a dab of solo Turkish flute. But whatever elements were joined in Passion Sources, it plays like folk music. A clever connoisseur's selection of it, but folk music nonetheless. The Passion soundtrack itself, however, is a world pop record. Why is Passion clearly pop when it includes several of the same musicians and some of the same rhythms and melodies as Passion Sources? Well, Peter Gabriel plays synthesizers and adds instruments like electric guitar, but the main point is he bends every African, Asian, and Indian influence to his will. He doesn't try to fit his arrangements or sense of pace into his folk sources. Brit rockers have always been particularly canny about this sort of transformation. Remember, the Rolling Stones didn't just copycat Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters tunes. Even after you heard the originals, the inventions of the Stones were undeniable. The final distinction between folk and pop is how much the music speaks to non-specialists, mere foreigners. Passion Sources sounds about the same on the 10th listen as it did on the 3rd. Passion, on the other hand, just gets more and more coherent and turns friendlier and more conversational with repeat hearings. It was made by a truly international pop performer. Passion remains a soundtrack, though. It's driven by the need to create various moods rather than its own internal pulses. The first side is quite peppery, high noon boogie. The last side is quite languid, late night noodling. But whatever time it is, you should study under Dr. Gabriel and give yourself an A just for doing it.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes regularly about pop music for The Village Voice. He reviewed Passion and Passion Sources, both on the Real World label. This is Fresh Air. The Feld Ballet mixes the elegance of classical dance and the freedom of modern dance. The company was founded in 1974 by Elliot Feld. Since 1978, he's also run a dance school that recruits from New York's public schools. There's no tuition, and the city provides bus transportation. Two former students are now members of the Feld Ballet. Elliot Feld formerly danced with the American Ballet Theater and performed on Broadway. He's choreographed about 60 dances. I asked him about the difficulties of integrating ballet and modern dance.
Well, I think that the classical tradition is one of lightness and the disguise of effort, so it should never appear difficult. And modern dance comes from a tradition of the earth, that things are down into the ground, and it tends to be more expressive of emotions that are familiar to us. It doesn't deal very often with princes and with fairy tales. So the notion of making ballet, or the feeling to make ballet somehow more expressive or more a part of our lives as we understand them and as dancing is today, I think is a kind of an attempt to reconcile that feeling of lightness with ground.
When did you first start studying dance?
I started at 11 years old at Balanchine School, the School of American Ballet.
Was this because you wanted to, or because a parent suggested that it would be good
for you? No. I don't know why I wanted to dance. I had probably only seen Bambi Lynn on the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm serious. And I just always did, and I don't know why.
Were you ever afraid of the sissy connection that, you know, friends would think, oh, you know, he's queer, he dances ballet?
No, I wasn't afraid of that because I just didn't let them know. Because
you
clearly,
didn't let them know you danced?
Yeah. I used to go at age 11 from Brooklyn to Madison Avenue where Mr. Balanchine had the school. And I used to carry my dance clothes in this little black attaché case as though I was on my way to Wall Street or something. You know, it's the child broker. But then I went to the High School of Performing Arts, and I mean, it was not a big deal.
Well, everyone's into the arts there. Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think it had to do with dancing. I mean, as you're, you know, finding your own sexual identity, that's a very scary time anyway. I don't think it was made more fearful because of dancing.
Were there any advantages being one of the few boys who was dancing of your age?
There were great advantages. I started dancing in 1954, and I was one of two boys at the School of American Ballet, one of two in the entire school. And so 3 months after I began, I was the little prince in the first production of The Nutcracker. Well, you know, I went from a kid from Brooklyn to being a prince in a classical ballet in 3 months. So I certainly know the rewards of there being very few male dancers. And now the competition is much greater. And I'm grateful, because I did not have a great facility for ballet dancing, that the competition was not as keen when I was coming up.
I think it was when you were 16, you joined the cast of West Side Story, and you were in the Broadway version, first, I think, as one of the Sharks, and then as Baby John?
Yes.
And then you were in the movie as Baby John, too.
Correct.
How did you get the part at age 16?
I was actually walking on Broadway with a girl I was going with, and she said, "I dare you to go backstage and sign up for West Side Story to audition." So I went backstage, you know, on a dare, you'll do anything. And then I got a call to come to an audition. There were hundreds of people. And through a series of auditions, I was selected. And there was great cachet to being in the show. I mean, in 1958, it was the show. And you got to grow your hair long, and everybody knew you were in it. It was wonderful.
How did you feel being this gang member, breaking out into dance?
Well,
I love the show, but there's always something like slightly incongruous about it, you know, because you always expect, well, gee, gangs, it should be like a rock and roll soundtrack or something. This was
before rock and roll. This is when 58. Rock and roll was Dion and the Belmonts. I mean, that was
nothing
rock and
wrong
roll.
With that.
No. But I mean, it's not rock and roll like today. But it's interesting. In the show, I think because theater tells you to suspend certain realistic expectations, that once you enter that world, you forgive its conceits and you actually embrace those conceits. So I don't think in the show it bothered me, but whenever I would see the movie, I always thought, why are these guys dancing? I mean, because the buildings were real, the cement was real,
yeah.
Everything was real, and somehow I couldn't make, why are these fellas dancing? I don't understand it. So I know the feeling that you're talking about, but on the stage I found it credible.
I think after West Side Story, you did a couple of other shows. I think you danced in Fiddler on the Roof.
Right.
And I Can Get It for You Wholesale.
Right.
Did you like being in those kinds of Broadway shows? They were...
Well, mostly I did it for money.
Yeah, sure.
Quite frankly. I was in American Ballet Theater when I did Fiddler, and we were on, you know, a six-month layoff, and I called Jerry and I said, you know, is there any work anywhere? I mean, I needed to pay my rent. And he said, yeah, go see Tommy back at Fiddler. I think that we can find something. And in 3 days after that, I was in charge of the show because Tommy had to go to Israel to set the production in Israel.
Huh. You danced on some of the TV variety shows, right?
Right.
Gary Moore, Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
Let me guess, were these production numbers where there was maybe a slightly washed up female singer
well,
doing
actually,
a number,
not necessarily. I mean, I danced with Liza Minnelli.
Really?
I mean, I didn't dance with her. I was one of the backup fellas. So it wasn't always washed up people. She wasn't washed up. I think she was about 18 at the time.
Right. Did you enjoy the choreography? My personal memories are of some very kind of corny choreography that came out of
Oh, it was crap. I mean, what are we talking about? It was awful. I mean, it was just terrible. But I was young and ignorant, and it was great, so.
Okay. You founded your company in 1975.
Four.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Why did you want your own company?
I didn't like working for other people, Terry. It's really a question of trying to find the freedom to do what you feel the calling to do. And in the context of a large institution, which ballet companies are, they're large institutions, your needs are secondary to the institutional needs. And so I decided that for me, the best thing was to have a company of my own, if I could manage to. And although one gives up many the prerogatives and to be much easier to let somebody else pay the dancers and to let somebody else rent the theater and to do all of that, I found it that it served my professional and aesthetic ambitions to take on those burdens because it gave me a kind of freedom I couldn't have otherwise.
Do you have to keep up to a schedule of new dances for each season? In other words, do you feel like you have to work almost on a quota of coming up with a certain number of new dances every year?
Well, I do, but more from an internal, more for myself than for the company.
Oh, so that you feel that you're keeping fresh and
so
producing.
That I know that I'm alive.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I finish a ballet, the great fear is that, will I ever have the feeling to do another ballet?
Yeah.
I mean, there is a day when I finish it and I look and I say, yes, I did it. And then the next day it's like, okay, so what are you going to do now? But sometimes it does feel a little bit like the tail is wagging the dog. I mean, when you really get exhausted and you're replacing dancers because dancers come and go. Like anything, there's the despair of the fact that you never arrive. There is no such thing as getting there. It's all just trying. It's all effort. It's always beginning again. It's always beginning again. That's what's exhausting about it, and that's what's thrilling about it.
It must be really frustrating when a dancer who you really like leaves, either because they're retiring or they're forming a new company or they're going to another company.
It's only a small death. Yes. No, it is. I mean, the dancers that you that become your means of expression, with whom you have shared the most intimate. I mean, it's not that it's intimate in a social way necessarily, but in a professional way, which is often much deeper. That these what you felt were commitments turn out to simply have been temporary, and it's you really have to harden yourself to it, because there were times when I just thought, I just can't go on. I mean, I have to quit. And then you start again. And that's when I'm saying that it's always starting again.
I guess that's another reason, too, why it's nice to know that there's a school that you're running with a lot of new people coming up through the ranks.
That's exactly right. That is why. Because it gives you the end, the beginning of the continuity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's there for you to see, so that when your end, which is the far side, may be in disarray, you can look back at the beginning and say, ah, but yes, in only 8 years, that child will be a wonderful dancer.
How reassuring can you get?
Yeah, that's right.
So what's your tour schedule like now for the next few weeks?
Well, the company goes from here to Glassboro and then to Nashville and Chattanooga, and then they're off for Christmas, and then we have a week at the Kennedy Center, and then we have 6 weeks in New York.
Well, great. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for doing the interview.
Thank you.
Choreographer Elliot Feld, founder of the Feld Ballet. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, tell us about your stories coming out of Berlin.
Well, we have reports from West Berlin, including many voices, jubilant voices of East Berliners who've come over to the West, taking advantage of the new freedom to travel. Also, some of whom were chipping away, literally, at the Berlin Wall. Also, news of what West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl had to say today about the spirit of German unity, and what the East German leader, Egon Krenz, had to say, and what the Soviets are doing, warning the Baltic republics to retract their aspirations toward independence, their declarations.
Well, you're heading to Germany tomorrow.
I am. I should be in Germany and reporting on the program next week.
Great. Have a good trip.
Thanks.
That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new movie version of Henry V, and film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
It's an amazing exercise in audacity. The 28-year-old English actor Kenneth Branagh deciding to out Olivier Olivier by adapting, directing, and starring in a new film of Henry V. Branagh is virtually unknown in America, although his ambitions and braggadocio have made him famous all over England. But the most unexpected thing about his movie is how gloriously good it is, as good in its way as Olivier's version. Branagh is very close to the age of the king he's playing. Olivier was 10 years older. And he has none of Olivier's built-in heroism. Branagh has the look of a lumpen prole who's just rolled out of bed. He has to earn the role, just as King Henry did. And with his James Cagney-like energy and a gorgeously modulated voice, he succeeds. As Henry earns the trust and devotion of his subjects, Branagh earns the fealty of his audience. Just listen to the emotion with which he invests the play's most stirring speech, the one Henry gives his ragged troops on the verge of the St. Crispin's Day battle.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhood's cheap.
while Zenny speaks, that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Olivier made his Henry V in 1944 with the financial help of the British government. It wasn't just a Shakespearean masterpiece, it was a rally the troops masterpiece, meant to boost the spirits of the happy few fighting the Nazis. But Branagh's movie is much more fashionably ambivalent about war. It depicts the battles as chaotic, muddy, and futile. The only glory comes in the speeches that surround them. This approach is intellectually messy, since Shakespeare too meant his play to be an unequivocal call to battle. And it's made even messier by Branagh's failures as a director. The movie's badly edited, and at times unnecessarily confusing. And yet, Branagh overcomes these deficiencies with the force of his acting and the acting of his cast. He makes Shakespeare's ideal hero no less heroic for the ignominious battle he fights. Henry leads his troops into an ugly and unworthy war, but that war also makes them greater men. And it gradually turns Henry himself from an ale-guzzling fop into a king worthy of his crown. The most miraculous thing about Branagh's film is the way it lets us in on the process. This is an intimate Henry V, and a profoundly cinematic one. If Olivier emphasized the play's theatrical energies, Branagh emphasizes its beauty as a character study. He uses close-ups, asides, whispers. No one on screen sounds as though he's projecting into the last balcony. And you've never seen anything like this cast. Branagh gets brilliant performances from Ian Holm as the Welsh captain, from Robert Stevens as the bitterly comic Pistol, from Paul Scofield as the sorrowful French king, and Judi Dench as Mistress Quickly, and from so many others that one can only marvel. If you're among those people who secretly suspect that Shakespeare is too lofty or stiff or difficult to be much fun, give Branagh's Henry V a try. It's not what those film critics on TV would call the feel-good movie of the year, but believe me, you'll laugh and you'll cry.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our show is produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl, with Roberta Sharrock and Joan Tui. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Carole King talks about writing hits for the Shirelles, the Drifters, Aretha Franklin, and herself. And we meet mystery writer Sue Grafton. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.